everybody out there, and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ozhahovsky, and on today's program, we're going to be speaking with Miriam Jones. Miriam Jones is one of the founders and runners of the Eastern Shore Sanctuary, Bird Sanctuary. She's done some amazing work, and we're going to be talking today about her sanctuary and about cockfight rooster rehabilitation. You're listening to Animal Voices, www.animalvoices.ca. I want to start the show today by giving a huge thank you to all of the people who made our fundraising drive a success last week. You guys are awesome. I had this was my first time doing the fundraising drive on my own, and I have to say it was definitely a learning experience. I learned quite a bit over the hour and over the weeks leading up to it, getting ready to do it, and I was really happy with all the support that everyone showed, and I just want to say a huge thank you to everyone who made that possible. You've sent a good message to CIUT that you want to see programming like this continue, and thank you. Here I am again this week, so you did your job well. Before we get to the interview with Miriam, I'm of course going to do some news, and the first piece of news I'm going to read today is a good comprehensive update courtesy of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation about the maple leaf plants problems that persisted after their finding of a listeria outbreak. And the headline says almost exactly that. Maple leaf plants problems persisted after a listeria find. A maple leaf foods plant that was scrubbed from top to bottom after a deadly listeriosis outbreak continued to have problems in the months that followed, newly released documents show. Inspectors found a troubling lack of hygiene at the company's Toronto facility just weeks after it reopened last year from a temporary shutdown for cleaning, according to inspection reports. Maple Leaf says inspectors were looking more carefully at the plant after the listeriosis crisis, so naturally they found more problems. Maple Leaf put in place more than 200 new standard operating procedures after the listeriosis outbreak, but it took workers time to learn them, said the company's chief food safety officer, Dr. Randy Huffman. He said that through the learning process, the company has continuously improved its approach to food safety. Huffman said that there was never any reason to be worried about the safety of the food produced at the plant. But according to the head of the Federal Food Inspectors Union, some of what the inspectors reported seeing at the time are, quote, things that people should be concerned about. Maple Leaf closed its Barter Road deli meat plant for nearly a month last year after its products tested positive for bacteria called Listeria monocytogenes. 22 people died and many more fell ill after eating tainted meat from the plant. During the plant's closure, the company invited television crews to film workers in what looked like hazmat suits dismantling and sterilizing equipment while other areas were coated in a foamy disinfectant. The plant reopened on September 18, 2008, but during a checkup less than a month later, Canadian Food Inspection Agency staff found mold on the walls and floor, slime underneath a meat trimming table, leftover meat on wheeled container bins, and rusty equipment. In subsequent checkups that month, the inspector reported that the rust had been sandblasted from the mock chicken equipment and that other problems had been fixed. But more issues turned up during another visit on December 12th. The inspector found small chunks of meat on a conveyor belt and on the buttons that operate it. A worker struggled to clean the equipment as the inspector looked on. Quote, he cleaned it three times to bring it to an acceptable level. The first two times, he missed pieces of meat on the conveyor belt, the report says. Pieces of meat were also found on the frame of a brine tank in the curing room, and meat and dirt were stuck to a broken stuffing machine in the kitchen. While not every infraction found at the Barter Road plant posed an imminent food safety threat, union head Bob Kingston said he's surprised a company that had been through such a high-profile listeria outbreak didn't hold itself to a higher standard of hygiene. Quote, in a normal operation that had not been through what they had been through, that might be a common occurrence, he said. But in this facility, it's very surprising that that would still be there, because you would expect it to be spotless. And another story coming to us from the CBC. The headline is, Charles and Camilla open Royal Winter Fair. It was a royal day at the Royal. Toronto's annual Royal Agricultural Winter Fair, known to everyone in the city as the Royal, was officially opened on Friday by Prince Charles and his wife Camilla, the Duchess of Cornwall. Charles and Camilla arrived at the fair in a horse-drawn open carriage, greeted by a large, enthusiastic crowd seated in the Coliseum. Many had lined up early both to see the royal couple as well as take advantage of free admission to the fair on the opening morning. The royal couple toured the exhibition, billed as the world's largest indoor agricultural show and international equestrian competition. After officially opening the 87th edition of the fair, Charles met with local farmers, while Camilla was taken to visit the canines taking part in the kennel show. The couple later headed to the airport and departed for Victoria, kicking off the next leg of their 11-day tour. The royals spent some of their time in Ontario meeting business leaders and musicians, as well as touring Dundurn Castle in Hamilton, home to one of Camilla's ancestors. The couple has already visited Newfoundland and Labrador, and will end their tour November 12th in Ottawa. And the final story today coming to us from the New Orleans Examiner. The headline is, Animal Abuser Sentence, But Was Justice Served for Katrina Dogs? Tammy Hansen was sentenced in Arkansas's Baxter County District Court on November 4, 2009 for 20 misdemeanor counts of cruelty to animals. The judge imposed a one-year sentence in the county jail and $10,000 in fines. So who is Tammy Hansen, and what significance does she have to Louisiana? The name tracks back 5 years to animal rescuers of Hurricane Katrina. Hansen's Arkansas property, where she operated Every Dog Needs a Home, here abbreviated as EDNA, Animal Sanctuary, was raided by the Baxter County Sheriff's Department in 2005. 400 to 500 dogs were found in deplorable conditions, some that had been rescued during Hurricane Katrina and transported there, only to be left in the cages they arrived in for days, covered in urine and feces. Hansen and her husband William were convicted of animal cruelty and released on bond. Tammy Hansen then fled authorities, but was found in Vermont in September of 2009 using another name. Checking on the history of this abuse case revealed the following. In a story written on the For Pitt's Sake website, founder Chris Crawford said she was contacted on October 5, 2005, and asked to take in the remaining 300 rescued pit bulls left at Lamar Dixon in Gonzales, Louisiana, where animals were being housed during rescue efforts. When Crawford responded that she did not have the facility to properly handle them, she was told that she would receive a, quote, significant amount of money to build a sanctuary. Due to the time factor involved in finding property and building a shelter, Crawford asked Christy Penrod, the caller who was organizing charter flights out for the rescues, if Crawford could, instead, contact her colleagues in Pitt Rescue to try to relocate them to already established places. The next day, Penrod called Crawford back and said that Tammy Hansen, supposedly a pit bull expert who operated Every Dog Needs a Home in Gamaliel, Arkansas, would accept the dogs. Not recognizing EDNA, Crawford made a call to Tammy Hansen, introduced herself, offered to help, and asked Hansen for references, to which Hansen replied, I don't give a F who you are. I'm getting $1 million to take these dogs, and I don't have to answer to you or anyone, and promptly hung up the phone. Crawford's website says some dogs were sent to EDNA before she and others could complete their investigation into conditions there. According to a 2005 news article, Posadas Safe Haven, with annual revenues of over $2 million according to CharityNavigator.org, also sent 50 dogs to EDNA before even checking to see if it was a reputable shelter. Questions still remain as to whether Hansen received money from animal welfare groups for taking in these animals. Can we say that animal welfare groups saved these rescue animals by bringing them to EDNA? Was the sentencing just and fair? The whereabouts of the animals from the property has not been discovered as yet. And that is the news for today, my friends. The bigger piece of news for myself is to say a huge, huge thank you again to everyone who donated to the show. I was so happy with all the support I received and that the show received, and thank you very much for sending a message to CIUT that you want programming like this to continue. There aren't a lot of forums out there for the type of talk radio that we do, and by sending that message to CIUT, you've managed to keep us on the air and to keep this avenue of communication open, so I thank you very much. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ozhovsky, and if I sound a bit hoarse or lower than usual, it's because I'm getting over a cold, but hopefully that won't impact the interview too much. Today we're speaking with Miriam Jones. She is one of the founders and operators of the Eastern Shore Bird Sanctuary. Founded in a rural region dominated by the poultry industry, the Eastern Shore Sanctuary and Education Center provides a haven for hens, roosters, and ducks who have escaped or been rescued from the meat and egg industries or other abusive circumstances such as cockfighting. We're going to be talking to her all about her sanctuary, all about the birds that she rescues, and specifically we're going to be getting into a little bit of talk about the rehabilitation of cockfighting birds. I think in a lot of cases, cockfighting birds are probably seen very much as, fighting dogs or other sort of animals that are bred to fight. They're not necessarily seen as rehabilitatable, rescuable, or adoptable. So we'll be talking with Miriam about that, and I think she has plenty to say about it. So, Miriam, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Not a problem. I really appreciate you being on the program. I wanted to start by just sort of throwing out there and asking how you got into animal issues and how did you come to your current understanding of animals that you have now?
Well, I'll just preface my answer by saying I can only speak for myself. There are others who work with the sanctuary, but I think it's a pretty typical story. When I moved to the shore, Eastern Shore of Maryland, almost 10 years ago, it was with the intention of forming some kind of sanctuary. In my head, I had already come to some understandings of what speciesism is and why humans need to change our relationships with other animals. But a lot of my ideas were pretty vague. And then I literally turned the corner in the truck I was driving, and there was a chicken on the side of the road. And I was with Patrice Jones at the time. She and I founded the sanctuary together, and we were both stunned, but we both knew we had to do something. So we picked him up, although we didn't know he was a he at the time, and were shocked when he started crowing, and that was really it. And so it was the evolution over years of, I think a combined approach to changing ideas about animals, both theoretical and real, having actual relationships with actual chickens, for the most part, has informed everything that I've done and Patrice has done and Aaron Polster has done, the three people most closely working with the sanctuary, over time to where we are today.
Maybe we could talk about the philosophy of the Eastern Shore Sanctuary, because you mentioned in what you were saying just there the combination of theoretical and sort of hands-on understandings. And one of the things that you mentioned in the description of the sanctuary is that the sanctuary works with an eco-feminist understanding of the interconnection of all life. And I'm sure that many of our listeners know what an eco-feminist understanding might mean, but some might not. So could you tell us a bit about what ecofeminism is and how it applies to the Eastern Shore Sanctuary?
Sure. And again, ecofeminism is a word that, like many other words of the sort, is understood differently by different folks.
Sure. Of course.
To me, one of the primary definitions of that word is connection. Feminism, again, there are a million feminisms, but I think one core element that feminism contains across all definitions is an understanding that females and feminism as applied to humans, women and girls cannot and should not be treated unjustly by a patriarchal system. And, of course, one could go on for 100 more years in that vein. Ecofeminism takes that concept and applies it to the entire world, not just humans. So we're talking about connections between animals of all sorts and the land in which we live and the water which we drink. No one species has the right to dominate over all others, just as men do not have that right in the human context. And that's a tiny little definition of ecofeminism. So how does it relate to in practice in the Eastern Shore Sanctuary? It's actually a very interesting question, because so much of our work has been done with roosters who are male. So one might sort of have a knee-jerk reaction thinking that's a contradictory thing. But if you look closer, ecofeminist principles apply very clearly here. Roosters have been piled high with human constructions of sex and gender for millennia. Roosters represent machismo of all sorts from a million different cultures. Roosters are forced to fight as proxies for human males. I mean, there are so many ways that sex and gender have been, our ideas of sex and our constructions of gender have been slapped onto roosters, both metaphorically and literally. So in working with them, we see a very different story, very different ways that roosters interact both with each other and with hens that are completely different from what popular culture holds. So in practice, that is definitely one way that ecofeminist principles apply, because we see through those layers and we work with the animals themselves to help them live the lives that they want to live and not the lives that we have decided they should live.
I want to revisit the cockfighting rooster subject and rehabilitation in a few minutes. And I definitely want to talk more about the gendered aspect of that and just of sort of animal blood sports more generally. To sort of give people an idea of what is the Eastern Shore Sanctuary, could you describe a typical day at the sanctuary? Actually, maybe first of all, where is it located?
We are actually now in Vermont.
In Vermont, right.
So that's a good place to start. And that's a whole other chapter in the work that we're going to be doing. So I don't want to say too much about that now, but big things are happening with us at the moment. A typical day is pretty, for us, day starts about 5 or 5:30 in the morning. We don't have paid staff, so we wake up and we go out and do what we call doing the chickens, which is opening all the coop doors. We've got 5 different coops at the moment with 2 yards that connect and 3 other yards that do not connect. There are different kinds of chickens in different kinds of situations, so having separate areas is important. One of the things we've been doing lately is carrying out the cockfighting roosters that we've been rehabilitating. If you wish, I can go into more detail about what that entails and why we're carrying them from here and there. But that would be the morning. Throughout the day, there are various tasks such as checking food and water, making sure everybody's okay, checking birds to make sure they're free of, you know, mites or that sort of thing, and then closing them up, all, of course, depending on when the sun rises and sets at any given point of the year.
How does the sanctuary stay afloat? Is it something that is, at this point, self-sustaining? Do you still have to keep a day job and that sort of thing?
Well, yes, we do have day jobs, so to speak. But the sanctuary itself is paid for by donations, very generous donations of individual members. So we haven't paid out of pocket for too many sanctuary expenses over the last few years. We do keep costs incredibly low. Again, at present, we don't have paid staff. We are big into the idea of freeganism when at all possible. So when we go to the town dump and we find used rolls of insulation for the coops or used rolls of fencing that we can actually use, we grab them and we use them. We build shelters for the chickens out in the yards from things we drag home from the dump. And that helps keep costs down as well. But at this point, the food, shelter, vet, all of those costs are paid for by donation.
In addition to doing rehabilitation and rescue, it says that you also do education and research. Can you tell us a bit about what that means?
Well, sure. Actually, at present, we've got two big educational pushes going on. One is the Rooster Rehab program, I guess you could call it, because the more folks who are willing and able to rehab these guys, the more they won't have to be killed after cockfighting busts occur. The other is the growing trend of backyard birds. That's just a catch-all name for, I honestly don't know if this is occurring as much in Canada, but here it's almost achieved fad status. Everybody in every city wants a little flock of hens, and there's a key word right there. They want fresh eggs, and they want cute little chickens in their backyards, and I don't mean to be sarcastic with my tone, but it really is a big problem, not just for the hens and how they may or may not be treated, you know, poorly, but in terms of the roosters, who are always sent in boxes from the hatcheries as either mistakes or packing material, who are almost never wanted, who are almost never legal in the places where they're brought to, and who are either killed or abandoned or dumped at shelters. And so we have been working with a few other sanctuaries to create a general statement that we are getting out to the public as we speak to try to educate people as to the reality of backyard birds so as to try to stem this tide before it gets too big.
At current time, I know that in Ontario, I believe it's something that's covered province to province here in Canada, and I know that at this time in Ontario, it still is illegal, although, you know, because of the sort of growing local food movement, it has gained a lot of traction, and I know that there's been legal challenges, you know, with people sort of not being sued, but, you know, getting into sort of fights with the neighbors and defending themselves legally to be able to have backyard birds and other sort of these, like, mini agriculture backyard operations, and in various neighborhoods, even in a city as dense and as populated as Toronto, there are definitely people who are keeping birds in their sheds or in their garages, and it's very it's fairly hush hush, and it's not something that you would see necessarily out in the open. For example, if you're walking behind people's houses, you might not just see it, but a bit of poking around, you would definitely find that is happening here for sure. We're going to take a very, very short break, and when we get back, I'd like to first get into some talk about cockfighting rooster rehabilitation, because that's something that I think you guys do that is totally different from what a lot of sanctuaries do, and that is a big reason why I wanted to have you on the program.
That would be great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Miriam. We're going to take a very short break. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Again, if you have any questions or comments about this show or any other show, you can drop us a line at animalvoices@gmail.com. And this show will be archived soon on www.animalvoices.ca. We're going to go to a station ID and be back with Miriam Jones from the Eastern Shore Bird Sanctuary. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ozhovsky, and I'm your host for today's show. Today we are speaking with Miriam Jones from the Eastern Shore Bird Sanctuary, and before the break, we were talking a little bit about what the Eastern Shore Bird Sanctuary is and what they do. And one of the things that separates them from a lot of other sanctuaries who rescue birds, such as chickens, hens, is that they also rehabilitate cockfighting birds. So, Miriam, I wanted to ask you somewhat of a devil's advocate question. Why?
That's a great question. And the answer depends on one's perspective on roosters. If the viewpoint of a fighting rooster is that he just is that way, then it sort of makes as much sense to do talk therapy with a psychopathic person. If, however, you see and you know the process that people go through to turn these roosters into the fighters they become, then it becomes a very simple question to answer. Everything that is good about a rooster is taken and twisted and perverted to turn him into a fighter. Roosters in the wild, or so-called domesticated roosters who have not been trained to fight, are naturally protective. They will have bats, but they get over them and move along. If a hawk comes, they are screaming at everybody to get undercover, and they themselves will stand out in the open to make sure that everybody does that. And I could go on with examples, but those are some of the natural tendencies of roosters. Mm-hmm. And what happens with the cockfighting industry is that they are taken, and this tendency to be protective is over time through things like starvation, temperature extremes, really talking, you know, Abu Ghraib and that sort of deal, classic brainwashing and torture techniques to turn them into fighters. So they are constantly on alert. They are constantly terrified, really, is what a lot of it comes down to. Terrified, and instead of the flight response, their response is always fight. So why? Because we as a species have turned them into what they are. And so if there is a chance to turn them back, it has to be done ethically. They're not happy the way they are. And because it's possible, it's mandatory, I think, to do as maybe not the individual responsible for what happened, but as a member of the same species.
We mentioned in our correspondence that many other sanctuaries don't do this type of rehabilitation work with cockfighting roosters. And I know that, you know, in all the sort of hullabaloo that followed after the Michael Vick case, there was a lot of sort of just talk. And in Ontario as well, we've had, you know, a ban on pit bulls and that sort of thing, like breed-specific legislation that's sort of aimed at more or less eliminating aggressive animals from the environment. And why is it that you think that other sanctuaries don't do this type of work?
Well, I think there are many answers. I think one reason is, and I don't mean to sound specious, but for example, why, sort of similar to why we don't take in horses at the moment. You know, there are so many aspects to animal liberation and sanctuary work that one cannot do all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one. I think another reason is perhaps not always knowing how to do it. Another reason is it does require a considerable amount of work in the early stages, and by early stages I say the first month to 2 months. And by work I'd say an hour or two a day at most. So not everyone has the resources to do that.
And this is per bird, an hour or two a day per bird?
It can sort of overlap. If this is a good time, I can sort of briefly outline the process to explain. Basically, what underlies the process that we use to work with these birds is, again, the idea that they're terrified. So desensitization is a big part of what we do. We set up cages in the yards. And the cages are metal cages that you can see through, and they're large enough they can walk around in. So they are out in the yards, but they are not able to interact with the other birds. So what they can do is they can watch everybody else go about their business and not rip each other to shreds, which they haven't seen before. Other birds can come and try to fight through the bars, and they will respond. There's definitely some cuts here and there, but they are also able to retreat to the middle of their cages and not engage. Mm. And that's something that was not possible for them either. Mm. And then we bring them inside at night into coops where they sleep in their own crates, and we do that every day. So for the first week or so when they arrive here, that's what we do. We don't even try to let them out of the cages because they just need to get their bearings and see what's going on. Where the time comes in is after that, when we open the doors. And this is to answer the question of how long it takes, depending on where the cages are, you can open one or two at a time, you know, and depending how many birds you're working with at once. You open the doors. What will almost always happen the first time is that they will come out, and within a minute there will be a fight.
Mm-hmm.
it is very easy to break up these fights because they're so intent on the fighting that they don't even notice you coming up behind them.
Mm.
So you grab them and you put them back in the cage. And then you do the same thing over and over and over once or twice a day. And what happens every single time, and I mean every single time, is that the amount of time out of the cage gets longer and longer. And what you also see, which is very interesting, is that, I want to say 9 times out of 10, but I don't know if I'm right, but more often than not, they aren't the ones picking the fight. And they are quite often the ones running away from the fight.
Mm.
And it's heartbreaking because these are tough-looking birds. A lot of them have had their combs shaved off, which is another thing cockfighters do, so that when blood is drawn, actual damage is done. I mean, they look like fighters, and you watch them, and they don't want to fight.
Mm-hmm.
They just, I mean, yes, sometimes they do, but over time, it's like an understanding dawns in them, and they realize they don't have to anymore, and they don't want to. So we got, about 5 weeks ago, we got a group of birds from Virginia, from a cockfighting bus, and we've been working with 6 of those birds. 2 of them have been adopted out, and one of the 2 who were adopted out is already out of his cage 5 weeks later. We've got 3 out of their cages now, 2 of them in the same yard, alone together,
wow.
for about 2 weeks, and they sleep together in the coop, and they're just fine. A 3rd is in a different yard, and then the rest are still working on their own process, but that's where the time comes in, because the longer they're able to stay out of the cage before they fight, that's how long you have to stay out there and make sure that they're okay. And, you know, it can be an hour before fighting happens, but you still have to take that fight seriously and take them and put them back in the cage. And then eventually the day comes and that's it, they're done and they're loose.
Now, I assume that if I went to the bookstore, I wouldn't be able to find a book that was called, you know, How to Rehabilitate Cockfighting Roosters for Dummies or that sort of thing. So how did you learn how to do this?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say we would love to publish a book like that one day, and that is on our list of things to do whenever possible, whenever we have the time. It was trial and error at that point. Patrice Jones and I were operating Sanctuary, and she's got a significant background in psychology. I have also a background in psychology, and it just seemed to make sense. Our first experience with cockfighters was a chaotic sort of free-for-all mess. We took in 29 at once.
Wow.
We didn't have the cage system. Interestingly enough, they mostly worked things out. I can't say there were no losses, but most of them worked things out. But we learned that we couldn't do it that way again. So we just came up with this idea. We got as many cages as the yards would accommodate, because that's another key to this whole process is you need to have sufficient space. A lot of these guys don't want to be up close and personal with birds for the rest of their lives. They like alone, and so you need space for them to do that. So we just will take in as many as we can accommodate at one time, and as many as the yards can absorb, again, given that space requirement. So how it happened was just thinking about what is motivating them to fight, thinking about the emotions behind the fighting, thinking about how would we help a human who was in the same situation. And then how could we apply that to roosters? And that was pretty much how we did it.
Maybe I could ask another devil's advocate question, if you don't mind. I imagine for some people listening to the program who may just be tuning in their cars or on their radios at home, who may not be that familiar with animal issues, and even maybe people who are familiar with animal issues, who know about sanctuary work and who know about, you know, the struggles of dealing with how and where to allocate resources, I imagine that some people might be thinking, you know, wouldn't it be a better use of resources to concentrate on animals that are easier to deal with, so you could help more individuals, maybe?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question, and I certainly can't fault a person who chooses, for example, to focus on sheep as opposed to cockfighters. The world of animal abuse is so vast that wherever you focus your resources, you're bound to do some good. And it can't be faulted in my mind. But I think an answer to that question, why bother with the cockfighters, might be found in thinking about the child soldiers in Sierra Leone who are, you know, snatched, trained, brainwashed, and forced to fight, right? And I hope I got the country right. But
you did.
Okay, good. But the point is,
you could probably pick many other countries.
I was going to say, absolutely.
Yep.
These children are a drop in the bucket of the human children who are exploited and abused and hurt in our world. Yet a vast amount of resources, and certainly probably not nearly enough, but are spent to pretty much do with them what we're trying to do with the cockfighters, which is to help them learn that they don't have to be terrified every minute of their lives, and they don't have to respond to terror with violence. We as a species, aside from the people who are exploiting and twisting these children in this way, understand that it is in part about the children themselves, because they never chose that life freely, and so it's an ethical thing to do to help them. But it's also more about a broader issue, which is the tendency and the choice of certain humans to take, and I hate this word, but I'll use it anyway, an innocent creature. You know, we all mold children in one way or another. Every species molds their young. But to twist the natural instincts of a child and turn that child into a violent, violent person, there is something about that decision to do that that is in itself abhorrent and needs to be addressed in a public way and in a global way. And it's the same thing with the cockfighters. Humans have chosen to take the natural instincts of roosters and twist them and pervert them and turn them into creatures that they would never have chosen to be on their own. And so, yes, individually they deserve another chance, just as individuals, but in a broader sense, this practice has to be publicly addressed, not just by busting up the cockfighting ring, which is happening more and more, but also by offering solace and healing to the victims of those rings.
Returning to the question of gender and cockfighting, you mentioned, and I think, you know, for most people listening at this point, it should be fairly clear that all cockfighting birds are roosters. Is there a particular reason why roosters are chosen over hens? You were mentioning the various sort of natural instincts that they have and the way that those are sort of played upon and twisted around. Are those instinctual characteristics particular to the male of the species?
Well, before I answer that question, I would like to add that we actually do take in a fair number of what we call cockfighting hens, who aren't fighters themselves, but they're breeders.
Okay.
So just as, for example, in the same sorts of conflict in regions where civil wars are going on, girls, too, are taken and abused and exploited. Hens are used as well. So they're used to breed, and they're kept in cages in horrible situations. But no, they're not fought. And interestingly, anyone who's lived with chickens will tell you that hens will fight each other.
Sure.
They will act protectively. And so the answer to the question as to why roosters are focused upon for the fighting, in my mind anyway, and I haven't investigated the history, and we're talking millennia of cockfighting, but I strongly suspect it has to do with the projected images of masculinity that are placed upon roosters that are not placed upon hens. The men who, and it's almost always men still, who are fighting the roosters, who are training, and I put that in quotation marks, brainwashing the roosters and then fighting them, they want to see a male. There is so much, I mean, if you think about the popular language, you know, cock of the yard and cock of the block, and, you know, you could go on and on. There is a a great deal of investment placed in the maleness of these birds. And one aspect of our constructed masculinity as humans is fighting, violence, warriors, you know? And if my rooster beats your rooster, somehow I feel like I've beaten you up, and somehow I get some of that glory. I think there's a lot of that at play going on, and I think it would not serve the same gender purpose, if you will, to have hens fight each other. I have no doubt that hens could be brainwashed to fight each other. I just don't think it would serve the same purpose that the patriarchal construction of this whole endeavor has created. Same with bullfighting. Why aren't cows trained to fight? It could be that they couldn't be trained to fight, but I have a lot of faith in the ability of humans to essentially brainwash each other and anyone else pretty thoroughly. I wouldn't think it couldn't be done, but there's a lot riding on that bull. You know, that...
Well, it's certainly not as impressive for a matador to, I'm sure, to kill a female cow.
That's right.
I'm glad you brought in, and I didn't mean in any way to overlook the role that hens might play in the sort of overall cockfighting industry, as you termed it before. So I'm definitely glad you brought that in. Could you maybe, you've already started to sort of paint a picture, and now it's getting a bit more filled in of what that cockfighting industry looks like. But it's not an industry in the same way that we think about the factory farming industry or these different types of animal industries that are sort of above ground. I'm wondering if you could maybe describe a little bit more. We've already talked about sort of some of the money involved in these fights and the idea that the hens are used as breeders. Could you maybe give us a bit of a broader sense of what the cockfighting industry looks like and the scale of it, maybe?
Scale is a more difficult question, again, because at this point it's illegal in all the states. So, as you say, it's almost entirely underground. It wasn't underground entirely until relatively recently. There were some holdout states, but it's underground. So scale is tricky with any kind of similar industry. What does it look like? Well, let's see. First of all, I could be a breeder and seller, or I could be a fighter. So right there, you've got a couple different... You know, there are different cogs in the wheel. So if I am, say, a breeder, I will have a lot of hens. I will have them obviously locked up pretty tight, generally kept outside in metal cages under a tarp. There's a little expense, you know, going toward the comfort of the birds. I don't need too many roosters to impregnate them. I do have, you know, similar to a stud farm, for a horse, I'm going to have a rooster or two or ten whom I think are the best. And I'm going to make a lot of money because my birds are going to be very valuable, particularly if they're considered to be good fighters. So, you know, I could be a breeder. I could be a fighter as well. The fighters travel, sort of like a traveling craps game. Again, it's illegal, so a lot of information about where fights are held is definitely word of mouth. It's certainly not advertised in the paper. And I'm going to crate up my roosters and truck them wherever I need to go for the next fight. I will probably, if my rooster is seriously injured in a fight, I will spend what looks like Herculean amounts of time and energy to help him get better. But that's because he earns me a lot of money and status. So the injured ones aren't necessarily just killed immediately if they're seen to be overall good fighters who can win in the future. So it's traveling fights. It's a lot of cages under tarps in people's backyards or in their garages. There are a lot of variations, too, in terms of, you know, people have definite ideas in their heads, just like they do with pit bulls, about what kinds of people are involved in this sort of endeavor. There's a broad spectrum of cultures and ethnicities involved in cockfighting. We've even taken in tiny, and I mean tiny, little roosters who didn't stand more than 6 inches tall, who were fought on bar tables in Pennsylvania, I believe. So there's a lot of variation within that particular industry, but at this point in particular, it's very clandestine, and getting more so because law enforcement officials are really cracking down. And what's very heartening is they're cracking down in a very compassionate way. There isn't the desire anymore to just routinely kill all the birds. We get a lot of calls from very compassionate law enforcement officials who would like to see these guys placed. So because of that, it's even more underground. So there's a lot of undercover work that has to go on to uncover these. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but...
It definitely does, and I want to sort of, we've got about 5 minutes left. I wanted to ask, you know, without asking you to give away specifics, because obviously that's probably not a good idea, but how do you come upon the birds that you have at the sanctuary, and how do they get to you? When you mentioned the first group of fighting birds that you got was 29, did they just show up at your door one day?
Luckily, no. well, you know, we do take in lots of birds from lots of situations, but cockfighting birds in particular at this point have come from one of two places, and we've taken in many groups over years. Most often we get a call from a sergeant in a sheriff's office in a county that has just broken up a cockfighting ring and they've confiscated the birds. What has to happen is the birds are kept in the animal control area of that county because they're seen as evidence. So until there is a guilty conviction, you know, they can't destroy the birds. They have to hold on to them because of obvious reasons. So we get a call usually at the right when the bust happens, can you take in the birds if this person is found guilty? You know, and then we go from there. If the person is found not guilty, that's it. The birds are returned. And this process can take months. So the birds essentially go from one sort of cage situation to another, obviously much better, but they're still in a limbo. We've gotten a couple of groups of birds from people working with law enforcement officials to break up rings, and they themselves have brought us the birds. And it's been a legal process, but it's one that we really can't talk about because it's, you know, all undercover work. But those are the two situations in which we'll get either roosters or hens from a cockfighting operation.
Miriam, we're down to about the last 2 minutes of the show, and I really, really appreciate you coming on the program today. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners have as well. I want to leave it over to you in the next 2 minutes or so to give any information that you can to our listeners about how they can either get involved with the Eastern Shore Sanctuary if they are in Vermont, or how they can help you otherwise if they're not in your area. And unfortunately, we haven't had a chance to really get into the issue of backyard birds. So maybe with your permission, if you have a document or any type of thing that you're using for educational material, we can post it on our website, because I'm sure that information will be useful for all sorts of people, not just in the Vermont area. I know it would be useful for activists in Toronto as well. So if I could, I'd like to turn it over to you, and if you have any final thoughts, and if you can give people a website or any other way that they can help you out.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for the opportunity. In fact, we've got a coalition statement. There are six sanctuaries who got together and created a short statement about backyard birds that we are making public. So I'll definitely send you a link. Anyone can access this statement on our blog. If you go to bravebirds, BRAVEBIRDS.org, go to the blog, the statement's right there. Please feel free to use it in any, you know, letters to the editor, backyard bird forums, any place where it can be of use. That's why we created this document. We have an opportunity right now to kind of turn back the tide that isn't going to exist in a couple of years. So now is definitely the time to get active in that particular issue. Anybody can please email us at sanctuary@bravebirds.org. Any questions from volunteering to how do I work with this rooster to anything, we're here. We're responsive to calls and emails, and that's why we're doing what we're doing. So anyone who has an interest in this work, we'd love to hear from.
Miriam, thank you so much for being on the program. We are now officially out of time.
Okay. Thank you also.
Not a problem. And we'll be sure to post all of the website addresses you mentioned and your contact info on our website, www.animalvoices.ca. Miriam, thanks again and take care.
Thank you. You too.
We were just speaking with Miriam Jones of the Eastern Shore Sanctuary. You can find out more about the Eastern Shore Sanctuary at bravebirds.org. But in the meantime, you can find out more about the past, present, and future of Latin music on Dos Mundos. Sergio's in the studio, and he's got some interesting gear here. Lots of buttons and wires and knobs and stuff. He's going to be twiddling. All right. This was Animal Voices. I was Carl Ozhovsky. I'll keep being him. Outside in the outside world, but for now, stay tuned for more.